kind of guys who'd make you feel like that. Oh no!
Hello and welcome to episode number 68 of Today in Digital Education, a weekly podcast by me, Di Barnes.
And me, Doug Belshaw.
That's Doug Belshaw over there. How are you doing, Doug?
I'm all right. How are you doing, Di?
I am winding back into the routine of work after a two-week half term, starting the second week back. And so this is the, we've got 6 weeks to go. So lots of good things been going on. I've had toothache this week, so I'm on antibiotics, very strong antibiotics, which means no alcohol for me.
Oh, dear.
But all is well, don't worry. A cool thing I did was I bought some lights. So in my flat, I've got quite a long corridor. And the lights, because it's a sort of service property, the lights are all very fluorescent-y, horrid. And so I don't use them. And so I bought these little sort of lights for less than a tenner a piece. They just sit along the skirting board. And then I bought them for the bathroom as well. So I can walk from the place I am in, either my bedroom or the front room or whatever, all the way down the corridor and into the bathroom. And it lights up as I go. And they just stay on. 15,
so basically, you've turned your apartment into some kind of emergency situation on an aeroplane?
That's exactly right. It's superb. So, they're not big, but they just provide enough light. And it doesn't, you know, when you wake up in the night and whatever, because loads of alarms go off at like 3 o'clock in the morning and stuff.
Did it already have the sensor built in, or did you like wire it together?
No cleverness on my part. I just bought them. They're battery operated, so you put them where you like. And I have them in the bathroom as well. So you go to the loo and it goes on for 20 seconds and goes on again if you move in front of it, sort of thing, just a little bit. It's great.
This is the kind of thing I wanted in my work, because I saw on Lifehacker having them underneath your bed and having them order thing, and then like different colours and the Philips Hue ones, which are bendable and stuff. But as ever, you know, my wife, which, and this is, to be fair, absolutely sensible. She wants things to just work. Like when she switches the light switch on the wall, she wants the lights to come on rather than, it's not quite connecting with the Wi-Fi server, you know, kind of thing.
these very simple battery operated ones.
Although she was quite impressed actually the other day when we lost the TV remote control in our TV. It's a Sony smart TV and it hasn't got any controls on the television itself.
Uh-huh.
So I downloaded the Sony app and controlled the TV from my phone. She was quite impressed with that.
That's always good fun.
Yeah.
Although in a family situation, that can go awfully wrong because people just start downloading the app and changing the channel. It's not good.
It's no different from me being about 13 years old and my best mate had a Casio infrared watch. I think I've said this before. Where you could control, you could tune it into different types of television. I remember him changing the channel when we're supposed to be watching a video in geography, and the quite old geography teacher had no idea what was going on.
Superb. I remember, pupils of mine in my last school would do that on their watches, and they'd do them for the projectors. So they would just program it. You just record the infrared signal straight from the remote into your device.
Right.
And it beams out that signal to the projector and it will the screen would blank off or it would freeze. So you're busy talking and you're not facing the board, you're facing the children, but you're using your computer and they would freeze the screen behind you and then you'd just be very, very entertaining, obviously.
Excellent.
Yes.
Well, I think it's something we're going to talk about today, I guess, in terms of students' digital skills and privacy and all that kind of stuff. So the title of this one, Digital Awareness, it covers a multitude of things, which I think we're going to tie together, but we'll see how that goes. Just before we do that, so you've been going back to work this week. Anything of note to mention other than the remote lessons that we'll talk about in a moment?
No, there's some cool tools in there that I use, some different web apps that I haven't used before. But other than that, I've been looking at ways of sending out, this is connected to what we're going to talk about as well in a way, but sending out the acceptable use agreement that I've made for the school and using a Google form, putting it in as a picture, and then the children will have to just sign up and agree, or read it and sign and agree to say they've done that, and we can keep a record.
Talk to Rob from the Scottish Social Services Council at Mosfest?
No, I don't know him.
Hey. The reason, the work he's doing with Open Badge is really interesting. So they've got a platform, all that kind of stuff. But what they're trying to do is badge behaviours. And the reason I mention it is the acceptable use policy. So what happens in every sector, I guess, is that, especially in public sector land, is that people create these massive reports that nobody ever reads. Then 4 years later, people say, has that policy, you know, document actually made a difference in the sector? And no one's ever read it, and it's just sunk without a trace. So what he's suggesting and promoting is badging the actionable bits within the policy document, which means that you can then follow through how much impact it's having in the sector. You can evidence it, and you can see whether it's actually those things were workable or not. And I wondered whether doing that for AUPs, acceptable use policies, would be a good idea.
No, I think that makes sense. There's a possible usage for it there, I think. But this is just going to be a first step in, I think, in trying to make a difference, because the acceptable use policy just sits as a document that needs to be signed prior to coming into the school. I don't think the children sign it. And just like terms and conditions in any app or whatever, it's not.
Oh, I see. So it's not even the kids saying that I will do this thing. It's parents saying my kids will do this thing.
Exactly, and everyone knows that you must. So as part of the digital induction, I always refer to it, but it's an 8-page document that just takes far too long to process. Even in a full lesson, it would be quite difficult. So there needs to be some way of doing it. So this is my first shot at doing it in an easy kind of way.
It would take some setting up, but remember when we talked about the idea of opening up different permissions, like either apps or parts of the web based on like web literacy?
Uh-huh.
You could potentially open up more of the network based on kids showing that they understand and are adhering to the acceptable use policy. Well, that's a massive overhead in a busy school.
Yeah, I think so. It's these things, either the policy is important or it's not. I think this is the thing. So the way I do it at the moment is an acceptable use agreement, which is just based on work that you've done as well, I think, years ago, which is respected.
Oh, it's Northumberland Church of England Academy, when I crowdsourced that AEP.
Yeah, absolutely. So it was just about bringing it back to something that could be, that had a visual element to it, so it could be put up as posters that would remind people all the time about there being an agreement. And rather than there being all the technical details, it is, you've signed up to this and therefore act appropriately. One of the things that always scares me a little bit in schools is how much stuff people are doing which does not adhere to policy. So the policy and the practice are completely unrelated. And I think that needs to be, we need to start addressing that.
I can remember having a conversation with a male teacher at my kid's first school. So Ben's in middle school now. But he was saying how he couldn't use his mobile phone to take a photograph at a sports day or a football thing or whatever. And I was like, oh, right, yeah, because acceptable use policy and privacy policy and stuff. And he just kind of, as a throwaway comment, said, of course it would be different if I was a woman. And I thought, yeah, of course, because although, like, everyone's supposed to be not using their personal device, there's some, you know, it is actually different if you're a man in a situation with young children and stuff. And so it does change in the social context. It's not a level playing field that the AUP is going into, I guess. Anyway.
Yeah, but I think these things are really probably complicated, and until someone actually prosecutes someone or disciplines someone, more to the point in a school, based on that policy, then the policy is not something that people talk about. Do you know what I mean?
That's true. It's therefore when things go wrong, I guess, rather than when things go right.
True.
Right, so this week, so we're recording this Tuesday night. I've been at VentureFest today. So VentureFest is, I think it started in Oxford, and I thought that it was the kind of thing that Elan Ezekiel would have been to, and lo and behold, he told me, yes, he had been to it. So the idea is it brings together people from all different kinds of sectors, but ostensibly it's for SMEs, small to medium-sized enterprises, people who have money to invest in those people, and consultants and people who are advising organizations, that kind of thing. It's not really the kind of thing I've been to before. Apart from maybe speak with my Mozilla hat on. But I went as a punter this time, and I have to say I found it really useful. You know, previously when I was involved just in education, I'd see that as a bit slimy perhaps, or oh, it's all to do with money. But actually, it was really good. Everyone was totally up for it. There was about 1,000 people at St. James's Park. So me, as a Sunderland supporter, walked into the belly of the beast and it was in the conference centre at St. James's Park.
Well, you're blessed. You're blessed. That's all I...
And it was really good. Saw stuff on lean innovation. Wonderful, wonderful talk by a guy who was an entrepreneur and took over first some newspaper shops and built that into an empire and sold it to Tesco. And he set up a whiskey distillery in the Lake District. He What else did he do? Hotels, all this kind of stuff. But the way that he told it and his approach to risk and failure was wonderful. Made some really good connections. People had actually heard about open badges without me having to mention it. People really interested in co-ops, digital skills, and just generally people interested in like raising all the ships in the harbour in the region rather than just their particular little bit of it, you know. So it was really
cool. Excellent. For those listening who don't understand, St. James's Park is the football ground of Newcastle United. The finest football club on the face of the earth.
Unfortunately, a league below, their bitter rival Sunderland, who I support, who are still in the Premier League by the skin of their teeth.
Skin of their teeth meaning they can't win a game, whereas Newcastle are like...
Hang on. We did win at the weekend, so...
Yeah. It's like a
terrible... Talking about Sunderland, I was with Brian in Sunderland last Friday. Sunderland City Council asked us to run a think-a-thon. Think-a-thon being facilitated thinking over the course of a day, and the particular problem that what they wanted to solve was the aspirations of young people within the city. So we had representatives of the council, of SME consortium, and the university and the colleges and all that kind of stuff. And we did some really interesting things, and we'll have to see where it goes next. We visualized people's career history to date. We looked at moments of transition and what credentials and inverted commas helped them there. And that was a really entertaining way of finding out about people. And we didn't even get round to doing the pre-mortem kind of activity. So more work to do there. The weekend, it was bonfire night. And so I live in Morpeth. I grew up near the sea in North Seaton next to Ashington. There's a place called Newbiggin where my grandmother used to live. Big beach, big long beach, fishing kind of town. And there was a bonfire on the beach sponsored by Rotary. So we went along there and had a great time, and some kind of family friends came along as well. And they set the fireworks off. And the way they were doing it, Di, was they had boxes of fireworks, the ones that you light the fuse, and then it kind of is on a timer inside itself, and it goes be-do-do-do-do-do-do, and it goes for about a minute. Then you move that one out of the way, and you get the next one, you light it. So there's kind of a gap in between the boxes. There must have been 12, 13 boxes, I don't know. But the people who were doing it, yes, they had high-vis jackets on. Yes, it was all cordoned off, but they were getting progressively more lax around health and safety as time went on. So by the end of it, by the last box, they must have been standing like no more than 2 meters away from the box. And then when all of them had finished and they were like, oh, that's all, folks, they proceeded to take the boxes and throw the boxes of fireworks onto the fire. And, you know, some of them don't go off. So then you had an extra display of loads of fireworks going off and landing in the sea. It was crazy.
It's quite funny. It reminds me of the fact that in China, in fireworks factories, lots of people actually die from it, from manufacturing fireworks. But also that the whole health and safety culture that we live under is now is very different. So for your children, it's a very different experience than it is for us growing up. But I have to recommend to everyone. About 10 years ago or so, I set off my first fireworks in our back garden in London. And what fun that is. I thoroughly recommend like fireworks in an inappropriate space. It is hilarious. And things do go wrong. It's quite funny.
The memory that popped up on Google Photos today was 4 years ago when we went on holiday, when my daughter must have been one, my son was five, and my parents came along with us. And we got this lovely villa in Gozo. Well, Gozo, still very much a family culture, and they still have fireworks factories owned and run by families. Mm-hmm. And one of them blew up while we were there in the pool, and it put the windows out of the house next door. It was that violent, even though it was across the valley. And basically, they lost every male member of their family in that explosion. So it's not just China.
Well, there you go. It's not just China. I know fireworks industry is huge in China, though. It must be. It's reported on every year around this time. I don't know if it's got any better, but certainly I remember big reports about it once upon a time.
Oh, the other thing to mention, if Ian O'Byrne is listening, when we were in Denver earlier this year, there was this bar we went to which had loads and loads of different spirits on the bar. And he is a bit of a bourbon drinker. I'm more of a whiskey drinker. And so we did kind of whiskey and bourbon flights and did little sampling things. And he introduced me to four or five different bourbons, including this one that I'm drinking tonight, Bullet Bourbon. And it's called a Frontier Whiskey. And I introduced him to some of my favorite whiskeys that they had, that I have back home. And so I've got this kind of Bullet Bourbon. So if you're listening in, cheers. I'm drinking this Frontier Whiskey to you.
Cheers, Ian. When I was an undergraduate, I used to drink bourbon by the bottle load.
Really?
Yeah. So I used to, what do we used to drink? Oh, so Jack Daniels was the staple. And then Wild Turkey and Maker's Mark. I remember we had Bullet. Had lots. We used to go and buy different bottles all the time, so we got bored of Jack. Buy lots and lots.
Well, I'll tell you how I bought that. My PayPal account had the exact amount of money I needed to buy that bottle when it was on offer, because I'd sold that number of copies of my audiobook, which I released chapter 2 last week, I think.
Oh, fantastic.
Yes.
Well, that's like, it's like serendipity or something, isn't it?
It's like crowdsourcing alcoholism.
Super. Well, cheers.
Moving swiftly on. So the topic of today's conversation is digital awareness, which is kind of a blanket thing. We want to talk about, I guess, three main things. So there was a thing this week which was in the Daily Mail, about more than 1,000 schools spying on pupils' web browsing. Also picked up in Ars Technica. There was the biggest technological change of the next 10 years not being any cool stuff, but being cybersecurity. And then the work that you did and you blogged about in terms of the remote lessons you did in a boarding school. So, yeah, shall we start there?
Well, let's crack in. Let's start with this sort of spyware stuff in schools. It's a bit weird. So these articles have come about through the Prevent movement, as it were, toward radicalization in schools. So we've had to do, we have a Prevent policy here at my school, and we've had to do certain bits of training on it over the last 24 months. And which essentially is just looking out for the signifiers that a young person is being radicalized in some way, and how to deal with that. Really, that's all it is. We haven't been told to install any kind of monitoring software at all, other than just some web filter monitoring, which we use anyway for different things. But these articles are very much saying that schools are becoming, or teachers are becoming, big brothers, which I find sort of quite strange. So I think there is sort of one positive thing to come out of all of these articles. But before we talk about that, I think what they're referring to, so there's a mixture of what they're referring to in the articles, which is using screen control software, like something like NetOp or something like that, which allows one workstation to be able to see onto the screens of many other workstations, and to control them, to launch web pages on them, to lock them, whatever, just to watch what they're doing. And so I've used that. I used to use it a long time ago. I don't use it anymore. To control people's screens within the classroom I'm working in, and then to be able to check their work without going around to their screens individually. Or indeed to remote in and help them from my teacher's machine, but that encouraged me to be lazy.
This is the thing. So it's very easy when you're in a position of power, as schools are. You know, people often draw parallels between schools and prisons, you know, in terms of the way that there's the routines and all that kind of stuff. And when you're in a position of power, then it's easy to go too far in one particular direction, because you've got no incentive to put the children's rights ahead of your compliance, for example. So even we mentioned when I was Dow TV learning at the academy, I inherited a system from the previous high school where it was a forensic monitoring thing. So basically, if it was capturing pretty much every keystroke that was happening, and if people wrote in something like suicide or, you know, something like bestiality or whatever it was, it would start monitoring and like more closely and start taking screenshots, and you could intervene, you could shut it off and do all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you say that to parents, parents are like, oh yeah, that sounds great. Yeah, I definitely want that. But there's no checks and balances as far as I can gather.
Well, I think it's quite interesting, isn't it? So we have trigger words like that for reports to be sent on the monitoring. So obviously everything gets monitored because it's computers. And if you think computers don't monitor things, as in don't store logs about what everyone does on this on a computer, then you're a bit daft. I mean, that just happens anyway. On the individual, even on your local machine, it will remember everything that you do, if you see what I mean. So the point is those logs are just being made available and categorized in different ways, and certain data are extracted. But really what it's about is a human intervention in that process, is when there's a person notified about whatever and what is done with that information, and that goes on. So there's something in one of these articles, I can't remember which one it is, probably the Faily Fail, where it says that 18 schools are going to be prosecuted, which I will have to go and look at in a moment. But there's also, it said that out of 1,000 schools that were looked at, only 149 had acceptable use policies. I don't know if that's strictly true. I wonder where that information comes from. I can't imagine a school volunteering and saying, we don't have an IT acceptable use policy. Every school I've ever worked in does.
Well, I think it's telling. I mean, I don't believe a word. I don't like the fact that we have to kind of cite the Daily Mail in this regard, but I don't really believe a word they say. But I think it is true that if you asked schools about what it is that they're doing in this arena, they might be a little bit coy about the software they're using, exactly what their policies are, etc. Because I feel like they might feel that they were doing something slightly wrong in terms of tracking students to the extent that they're doing.
Well, I think that's the case, isn't it? So it's an interesting sort of microcosm of the idea, should schools be monitoring what people use their services for? And this is a no-brainer for me because, you know, schools are full of minors. They're full of underage people. We provide web filtering. Certainly, I don't know of any school that doesn't filter the web. To remove inappropriate content, definition of which is maybe up in the air a little bit.
I can remember talking to a school, and in fact, I can't remember if it was me asking this question idly a few years ago, and it might have changed now, but I can certainly remember 5 years ago or so, there was actually no way for a school to legally buy unfiltered broadband at that particular time.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. But it's like, so that's that. And anyway, so you're going to monitor what people do. But if I'm, you know, like my children at home, for them to think that I'm not going to monitor our internet usage is just daft. Although I do remember, actually, it is really difficult. So it's not something that's provided by your ISPs, is if internet monitoring at all. So you couldn't, it was really difficult. I remember trying to do this once without installing a piece of software on every single device that was accessing our network to find out what websites people were visiting. Interestingly enough. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's changed because mine are all old now, over 18, but it's quite weird. But in schools, it just sort of makes sense that you're doing that. If, you know, if they're using our Wi-Fi, then we monitor that, obviously. I mean, why would anyone think...
The interesting thing now you've got, I remember talking about this back on EdTech Roundup and with, I think it was with David Noble back in 2007, so almost 10 years ago now, saying as soon as kids have got 3G, now 4G on their mobile phones, why would they use the school network? So I'm going over to Victoria College in Jersey tomorrow and help them out with their digital strategy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as I'm sure as happens in every school, when I had got the students together and said, so let's have a conversation about what happens and all that kind of stuff, they're not allowed to use their mobile phones apart from in certain areas. But when they do they use the school Wi-Fi? Well, no, of course not, because they're filtered on the school Wi-Fi network, whereas because they're on top of a hill, they've got full 4G.
Yeah, and that's the thing. So I know for a lot of schools, that have excellent 4G coverage within boarding houses, schools like mine, and we don't have this because we don't have excellent 4G coverage within the houses, they're struggling to make the pupils log on to their systems because that's what they want them to do. But obviously, if you've got good 4G access, then you wouldn't even you put your computer through a hotspot on your phone if you had enough data, you know. So the only thing that does it is the children have become very savvy about what they do on their phones, on their own data plan, and what they do on their school provider services. And it's up to parents to provide the amount of data that is suitable to each individual. But data plans are going to get cheaper and cheaper, I guess, allowing gigabytes per month. And
I saw something today, it was 32 gig for $14.50 a month, so... pretty cheap.
That's of 4G data.
Yeah,
so that's huge.
Mm-hmm.
I get 10 gig for a tenner a month, and I thought that was a superb deal.
Mm. So the thing which concerns me about all of this is, you can always legitimize what you do as an institution in terms of child protection, the prevent agenda, all that kind of thing. But just to quote what the Ars Technical article says towards the end, the second last paragraph, it says. And this cites a report by an organization called Big Brother Watch, which puts in freedom of information requests, FOI requests. And you can do that in the UK, you can do that in the US and other countries as well. And you can find out, I don't know if freedom of information requests applies to private schools like yours, Di, but it certainly does in state schools.
Oh, yes, it does. Yeah.
It does, right, okay. And so you can find out these kinds of things in terms of what kind of software is going on, etc. So from the report... the report that they're citing here is the one that Big Brother Watch have put together. So it says, quote, "The report also notes a more insidious danger the routine deployment of classroom spyware could engender. Coupled with the use of CCTV and biometric systems, it argues that there's a risk that spying on children could be seen as normal behavior," unquote. And as soon as kids are used to being spied on and they grow up and they become voters, then they're voters that are used to being spied on. So... we get the acquiescence to the IP bill, like is happening now, which we'll talk about later.
Well, I think that's interesting in that. So the idea that a young person can go to school and not be accountable for their behaviour at all times on that property. Why would you think that's not okay? I mean, I agree with this whole sort of spying thing. And CCTV kind of freaks me out, and I've had CCTV in my classroom before, and it's been an unpleasant experience, and etc. But CCTV for security around buildings, I know in my experience, has mostly been used to catch in school to catch children who are wherever at a certain time, like for petty vandalism or for smoking or things like that. And not to...
Well, okay, let's think of some hypothetical situations then. Okay, so you and I have both experienced when we were younger growing up in a place of relative deprivation and poverty, places where, you know, beyond maybe mobile phones these days and stuff, like, there's not necessarily... Even if there was a smartphone, they might not have a data contract or whatever, so there might be an access issue. So let's say that you've got a young person and... I don't know, like they're questioning their sexuality or something. And they've got literally no one to talk to because they'll be ostracized and they want to find out if what they're feeling is normal or something like that, something very personal. They don't feel like they can talk to anyone about and they just want to find out some answers, etc. And so the only access they've really got is on the school computers, and as soon as they start typing that in, they're flagged for like not obeying the acceptable use policy because taking them to... websites had to have something to do with like sex in the title or whatever, then
yeah,
you know what I mean? I feel like I was listening to something this week about the difference between treating things as edge cases and treating them as stress cases. So people talk about edge cases when they're designing software and systems and stuff, and it's easy to dismiss things which are edge cases as being like, oh well, we're talking about, you know, the 99% of people. But what this particular designer was talking about was, if you try and think about what was previously conceptualized as a edge case, as a stress case, as something which actually the rest of the people aren't going to feel very strong emotions when they're dealing with your systems, but these people are, then you need to kind of design to include those people too.
Yes, that's true. I'd subscribe to that. However, the actual behavior wouldn't be the same as that. So we wouldn't be looking for people who are looking for sex on our systems, because all the sex sites are banned in theory. And so that's not what we'd be after. We would, so that wouldn't get blocked. The thing, that would get blocked. It wouldn't get monitored and flagged. So everything's monitored. It wouldn't get flagged up to a person. And so things that the keywords that we would use, and that is a big discussion, is what keywords you use, and it's a discussion we have to have as a school, and that kind of thing. So would be
okay. Let's try a different tag then. So people act differently when they feel like they're being watched, as opposed to when they don't feel like they're being watched. Like there's some kind of psychological harm that's done when you feel like you're being watched all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And if so, right? So there's the question of whether people, so if you put a CCTV camera in a classroom, then people might eventually forget it's there, but subconsciously they know it's there, really. Whereas on computers, when you're doing background keyword searches, when you're recording screens, all that kind of stuff, that stuff's not visible unless you've explicitly signed up to something, you've been told about it, etc. So you're not really, there might be a sense of you're not self-censoring, or you're not aware that you have to be performative or act differently in that regard. But if you do realize you're being, everything you do is being tracked, then you're going to act differently in that world, which means you can't be an authentic version of yourself, which means you're not bringing yourself fully to the educational situation, if that makes sense.
I think it does, although I think you can get a little bit lost in that, because you can say that other things do that as well. Just like being in front of teachers. I mean, I feel like this is about teaching as a profession, love it as I do, is that eyes are on me all of the time, you know? So I guess the open plan offices have an issue with this as well. But you're being looked at, you're being watched all of the time. Even if you're not being watched, you feel that you are, you know, there's the capacity to be being watched or whatever. And that has an impact upon your behavior, and it has an impact on the choices that you make. And it's quite difficult. It's not just the technology that's doing that. There are other things, but the sort of thing, at least CCTV, you might argue, is explicit, as you say, and to a degree, and that the monitoring things that we're using, and that's the positive thing that I thought came out of all of these articles, is that actually, if we are going to be monitoring people, we really need to tell them how we're monitoring them. We need to tell them that their email is available to us and will be for another 7 years. We need to tell them that anything that they do on school systems, and that's what we do though, is we do tell them everything is accessible.
So, you know, Seth Godin and people like that, big revolution a few years ago in marketing, instead of just trying to like spam people as much as possible after the Can Spam Act in the US, the idea of permission marketing, that you're asking people if you can market to them, they're opting in, and it's easy to opt out, like it is these days with most email newsletters and marketing, that kind of stuff. And I feel like we need something similar in this regard. So here's the acceptable use policy. If you don't want to accept it, so ages ago we mentioned the case in California of the guy and his daughter who didn't want to sign sign up to Google's terms and conditions for Chromebooks. Can you remember that one?
All right. Okay. Yes.
Yeah. So there needs to be a legitimate way to opt out of, for example, the accept reuse policy. So if it's actually like, you know what, I'm not going to sign that, the school might say, well, if you're not going to do that, because IT is so fundamental to our school, you're going to find a different school. And that has to be like an informed choice.
Mm-hmm.
Or it might be, okay, well, we're going to find a way in which you don't have to use technology or whatever it is. But once they sign that thing, that I think it has to be a contract where they know what the benefits are as well as the downside. And it can't just be used as a stick to beat people. It has to be some element of a carrot as well.
Yes, I think so. And that's the problem I face, really, is that if someone doesn't agree to the acceptable use policy, that what does that mean? Does it mean they don't get a network account? Does it mean they don't get an email address? Does it mean they don't get internet access? And that, I guess we need to make a provision. You know, if you're going to follow this to the nth degree, you're going to make a provision for those people and then bespoke the needs of that person and make accommodation. So I'm just thinking about the photograph policy in schools. Generally speaking, in the schools I've worked in, it is that your child's photograph may be used for marketing purposes and published on the internet, by default, if you don't want this to happen, let someone know, like make sure, you know, contact the school, say that you don't want to agree to that. And then that list is a really interesting list, because what you have to do is make it aware to everybody who is allowed to publish things online or in the different publications that the school might produce. And then someone has
those
to...
People. Did you know at MozFest, did you see anybody with a yellow lanyard?
I don't remember.
What, I don't know if you were informed as to what that meant.
I remember there being something about coloured lanyards, but it wasn't top of my agenda.
Right, well, we were certainly told in the facilitator's briefing, if you see someone with a yellow lanyard, and I didn't see anybody with a yellow lanyard, actually. The rest of them were blue, I think. Then those people have chosen not to have... Not to, you know, they don't want their photographs reproduced online, and they don't want their photograph taken, etc. And I thought that was a very practical way of doing it.
Oh, okay, yes, it makes sense, doesn't it? And then so it's very easy then for stuff to be removed, or indeed for somebody who works at the festival to contact someone who's posted a picture on Twitter, say, and say, please remove that picture.
And that's fine as an adult, because, hey, you're an adult, and you get to make choices, like that kind of stuff. But as a kid, it seems like, you know, it'll be probably the parents who make that decision. And I guess it's another way of singling out different.
It is, and it's interesting, isn't it? Because this, in a community, quite often an organization like a school will have to make people do stuff that they don't really want to do. And if you ask them all the individually the question and told them all the implications of the answer of, you know, agreeing to it, they might well say no. But the truth is the way that these things are done is they're just sort of shoehorned in the back door, you know, and you just hope that they're not going to, people aren't going to complain and seek forgiveness rather than permission, kind of thing. That's sort of the general policy for it.
I feel like there's going to be a backlash more generally about the use of data once we find a good way of visualizing what's going on behind the scenes, when it's more than just words in an article and Edward Snowden being a disembodied voice saying, hey, this is really bad. Once there's a way in which people can see the material effect it's having, I feel like there's going to be more permission-based data sharing. And once we've got a way of keeping our data separate from the platforms, there are ways of doing this. So I was looking today again at something called Unhosted, which allows you to have web apps that separate your remote storage from the web app itself. And so you basically connect your data to the app rather than the data being in the app, if you see what I mean. And I feel like that kind of thing, certainly for people who are more privacy conscious, might become a bigger thing in future.
Well, I think so. But that just seems like a logical step. And one of the things, society doesn't really evolve in logical steps. You know, it evolves through different forces, like market forces, for example. And they're the things that get protected. A little bit like what you were saying, you know, CCTV and constant digital monitoring in schools is going to lead pupils to become accustomed to that and not really worry about it for when they become adult citizens. And therefore, they're not going to question policies that invade their privacy because they're familiar with it. They're used to it. It's just not a big deal to them. And I think it's much more... I think it's much what really is going to happen is people are just going to have to become much more careful about what they share and make choices about services and things. And after reading these articles today, I just went for a quick look for any encryption apps for phone calls and for text messages. I was thinking if I work for an organization and I was worried about sort of phone hacking, assuming that sort of thing is going to become more prevalent. And at the moment, I use WhatsApp quite a lot, and which is owned by Facebook, obviously, but it's end-to-end encryption on it. And you kind of trust the fact that it's got end-to-end encryption on it. You know, it's part of the system, and it tells you that if somebody is not using the encryption that you're talking with. And I just thought, I wonder how encrypted that is and how secure, you know, where does that encryption ever get decrypted? And can you, so there must be apps out there, services out there that you can pay for as an organization, which makes sure that everything that you exchange within your organization, be it digital, well, everything digital these days, is actually encrypted and secure. And then how do you trust the company that you're going to but they're well, not actually.
I put a link into the miscellaneous thing, but let's talk about this now, actually. So this week, can you remember when we talked about WhatsApp changing their privacy policy and you had 30 days to opt out of it and all that kind of stuff? Basically, the UK Information Commissioner, who's Elizabeth Denham, has said, hang on a minute, Facebook, you haven't really got people's consent because you've rushed this through in 30 days, and the way that you're using data hasn't been explained very well to users of Facebook and WhatsApp. So what they're actually doing is that they're, you know, Facebook are merging. They say that, hey, it's end-to-end encrypted, we can't read your messages, and that might be true, it is true. But the metadata around it in terms of who you're communicating with and when and where you're communicating with them, all that kind of stuff, that's what Facebook bought for $19 billion. Mm-hmm. So they're combining it with all that information that Facebook already have. And you know, we know that Facebook buys data from, for example, Tesco and Marks and Spencer's and grocery stores and loyalty cards and all that kind of stuff to merge mm-hmm. with its existing database to find out more about you so it can sell that to advertisers. So I, you know, WhatsApp is very easy to use. I started using it to message my dad when he was in the Middle East and things. But actually, when all the stuff I read, especially after Facebook acquisition, was a bit dodgy. And if you remember, we started using Wire. I messed about with Signal with my wife. Now, mm-hmm. this week, there's been a formal cryptography audit of Signal, and it's passed with absolutely flying colors. And there's an article on this in The Register, which is a kind of an IT online magazine kind of thing, UK-based. And it goes through some of the techie stuff, and it links to the PDF. But basically, it says that some of the tests that they would usually run on a crypto app, they couldn't even run on it because it was so secure.
But interestingly, even this says, at the bottom of this article, it says, and I quote, the paper does, however, cover only a subsection of Signal's efforts as it ignores non-Signal library components plus application implementation variations. It should therefore be considered a substantial starting point for future analysis, the authors say, rather than the final word on the Signal. But it is a very good indication that the app is secure. And it would be interesting.
So, you know, I remember when I was going to the far end of things when I started working for Mozilla around privacy and security and all that kind of stuff. And I'm still interested in this, but thing which I can't remember the exact article I read, but the general gist of the things that I was reading, which forced me to reassess just how far down that road I had to go, because it was really affecting my everyday life. It was, you know, it was putting barriers in my way of doing the usual stuff. It was basically saying you need to think of your threat model really, like, who are you trying to protect yourself against? And realistically, as I think I've said before in this podcast, I'm not really trying to protect myself against the NSA and GCHQ, because there's no way I'm smarter than them in terms of crypto and protecting myself and things. What I'm trying to do is prevent drive-by hoovering up of my data by big multinationals like Google and Facebook and whatever. Yeah.
Mm. I think that's fair enough. I think it's I don't know. It's quite difficult, isn't it? Like I talked about Google Maps last week and using it for as a sat nav, and I want them to have my data, and I want them to give me other people's data to tell me where the most likely black spots of traffic are going to be and reroute me accordingly and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I think freaky. This is freaky. I'm letting a computer tell me, an algorithm tell me where I should drive. To the extent now that I don't even pay attention to where I drive, I just follow the route that Google tells me, because every time I go against it, I end up taking too long because they are identifying traffic black spots, etc. And then how much should I be worried about that, and how much should I just allow that to make my life better? It's sort of quite an interesting thing. And to the extent that I kind of think, so to do privacy well, is it better to just put all my eggs into Google's basket and say, right, I surrender my privacy to Google, but not to anybody else, and I protect my data elsewhere, but for all the services where I want it to be good, I use Google Apps all of the time, and all different Google services, and so should I just let them, and a Google phone, you know, and Chromebooks as well, you know, just try to fight the Google bit and then and just be faithful to Google, as it were.
Well, I think that would be fair enough if it wasn't for the fact that we can be pretty sure that they're backdoored in some way, or, you know, if pressure was put on from governments that they would allow you to get in. You know, there was the whole Apple, iPhone, whatever. There's always going to be ways in. So you're never really just giving your data just to one party. So for me, my model, in the same way that I blog in lots of different places and I spread myself around the web, I think I'd rather put my data in lots of different little places.
Or little bits of data in lots of places rather than lots of data in one place. Yeah, I don't think there's a sort of right
there's
or wrong.
No right answer here. No. I put a link in here again, which I was going to talk about later, but the title by, so Jim Killick, I've mentioned before that I'm a supporter and member, and I pay my dues every month to the Open Rights Group, and the director of that, Jim Killick, says in an article for Newsweek, the IP bill, which has now been passed after going through the House of Lords, is the most extreme surveillance law ever passed in a democracy. And so basically it gives blanket coverage. ISPs, internet service providers, have to maintain logs for years about what's going on. And, you know, again, it's people focusing on terrorism and porn and all that kind of stuff. But really, it's an invasion of our civil liberties. It's blanket surveillance, which has been shown not to actually catch any criminals. All it does is give the government data on everyday people when they don't really need it.
Yes, it is, isn't it? So I'm somewhere behind the scenes, this is probably doing some good in part. It's just we're not told what it is. And this is very much like the acceptable use policy in schools, is that really people need to be told more about why it is that these things are being taken, even if you're being used, even if it's exposed to the government to more criticism in the short term. In the long term, it's better to be an informed society than not. And it also go back to the conversation I had when I adjudicated a debate on torture and whether torture should ever be used, even in extreme circumstances. And there's this massive book made by somebody from the CIA or something, written by them, and which says that there's not one case, or possibly one case, where torture has been used and actually intervened within a terrorist situation to make a difference to the outcome, and that's not really the useful tools of terrorism are to do with intelligence, not to do with actual torture. And this is the the interesting thing about
So it's interesting. So right now when we're recording this, people who are listening to this know the outcome of the US presidential election, but we are in a we know the outcome. And one of the things which is one of the big issues on the campaign trail has been attacks on Hillary Clinton by the FBI and others around her use of a private email server. Now, I was listening to a podcast called Tech Gypsies, which is recorded by Audrey Waters and Kin Lane, and excellent it is too. And this particular one that they recorded, and I wrote a blog post about this, which I'll put in the show notes. They really did a deep dive into, from the 20-minute point onwards, into, it's too long to kind of put in this podcast, even though it's under a Creative Commons license, I think. They basically talk about if people really knew what was going on with, like, how email worked, the private email server for Hillary Clinton would be a non-event. It's just not a big deal at all. And because people don't know how email works, then it becomes into this big thing. You have to listen to it to see what's going on. But the thing which reminded me of is when I did my thesis around digital literacies, and I kind of said, well, when I did this meta-analysis, here's all the different 8 essential elements that people talk about. One of the things I talked about was the civic element and how digital literacies have this element to do with society, and it's not just an individual thing, but it's us collectively. And there's really not enough general knowledge about how the basic tools, technological tools that we use every day work. So we're kind of captured by this Silicon Valley narrative around, oh, the big next thing is artificial intelligence and chatbots and blockchain and whatever. And I feel like, and that coupled with the elegant consumption, as Mitchell Baker talks it, about it, of apps and Facebook and things, everything's so easy to use, means that the stuff that really matters, like here's how email works, here's how to secure yourself online, all those kind of things are just too hard. And the other fantastic point that Audrey and Kin made in that podcast was that the learn to code movement is actually quite dangerous in the sense that it puts this massive chasm between people who don't really know what they're talking about other than using Facebook and social networks and the occasional email and, hey, I can code. And people who can code saying almost to the people who don't know what they're doing, oh, well, either you need to learn to code or just let us get on with it. And there's nothing in between. And I feel like that's the bit that's missing, this whole digital literacies piece, especially around civic engagement.
Oh, I think that's it, isn't it? But I mean, that's what you were doing at the Thinkathon in Sunderland, really, wasn't it? Is the idea of people just being aware of how these tools work. And I think, and I listened to Audrey and Kin's podcast, and it is, and Audrey makes a very clear, very strong point that if you actually, if you know how email works and you look at what was going on, it's just not that big a deal in that regard, sort of thing. It's difficult.
Yeah.
But so let's move on to, so I was reading an article by Kate Russell at the weekend. She tweeted it out, and she'd written an article called
so for those who don't know, there's a BBC, Kate's well known in the UK because she co-hosts a program called BBC Click, which is all about technology and that kind of stuff.
It's the BBC's technology news television show. And so she wrote this article for the website called The Question, and it was all about what will be the biggest technological change in the next 10 years. And people are always talking about robotics and artificial intelligence and whatever. And I think augmented reality rather than virtual reality is more of a big thing. But I think virtual reality is coming, will come in this time as well. But certainly artificial intelligence is still quite a way away, from, in my opinion. So she said, she cited the next thing that the next 10 years is going to be dominated by cybersecurity, which I thought was a very valid point. And she cites changes that are going to happen to the Data Protection Act from May 2018.
Yeah, I didn't know anything about that. That's amazing, isn't it?
It's quite interesting, isn't it? And it's going to be updated with the EU general protection laws, which will affect every, and even though we won't be in the EU, we're going to have to conform to these because we're going to want to trade with the EU. But it actually says that you can now be, which we currently buy about, gives fines of about half a million pounds for data breaches. That's the fine you get as an organization for a significant data breach. But now these regulations will change, and you'll be able to be fined up to 4% of your annual global turnover, which is clear to cite is not profit but turnover, or 20 million euros, whichever is greater. So therefore, companies are going to have to become very, very security conscious about their work that they do online.
I mean, the EU, this is one of the reasons, another one of the reasons why staying in the EU is so important, because you know, the Safe Harbor Agreement, which we've talked about many, many times on EdTech Roundup and here, and you know, the way that basically EU citizens can use US companies which use US servers, the Safe Harbor Agreement was seen as being not robust enough for the EU. So there's this new EU Privacy Shield, which companies have been scrambling to implement, etc. And now there's this on top of that.
Yes, and that this is, I mean, this is going to be a big deal, because as soon as somebody is prosecuted to the point of 4% of annual turnover, they're going to be, you know, it's a big company killer, and that's really what she's talking about. And therefore, more and more people are going to be required to work in cybersecurity and to understand security, and privacy will grow as an issue because of that as well. And so it says the cybersecurity market is expected to grow from $75 billion in 2015 to $170 billion by 2020. That's over doubling within
You know, she says here, she says, at the moment we get a lot of stuff free, but if you can imagine that you've got to protect against the potential of these kind of fines, then business models are going to have to change, end of quote. Now, there's yes, and maybe it'll start off by people becoming even more invasive around data mining, but hopefully, potentially, there'll be new non-advertising data mining models that come out of it.
Well, I do think it's quite interesting, especially with these systems that are taking hold, like have taken hold and dominate the market, like Twitter and Facebook. I mean, even here on the question, you've got a blue and a blue and a tweet thing. You know, share it on Facebook, share it on Twitter. These are the main platforms for social media, and of this sort of, you know, when you're sharing websites and things, and people would pay. I would pay for Twitter. I wouldn't have an issue with paying for Twitter now. It's a service that I value. The network I have on Twitter is something that I value, and I would pay. I don't need it to be free. I don't understand why this. So this free business model seems to be really important to everybody. But I think that is going to disappear. And I do think business models will change. I think people will start to pay for it, and it will be different prices. I don't think they'll need to pay very much for these companies to actually generate quite a lot of revenue because they have so many users.
I wonder if the whole question of the digital divide, which kind of 10 years ago was such a big thing, and I know that prices have come down and things, but you can't argue with free, and everyone has access at a very basic level when things are free. And if there is a paid model, whether the specter of the digital divide will rear its ugly head again.
Well, I think, I mean, it certainly would, but but the point is that whilst things aren't free, I mean, money is the currency by which we exchange goods in our societies across the world. I don't think there's a place where money isn't the thing. I'm sure there are sections of certain countries where that possibly isn't such a big deal, but not very many. It's all right to ask for money. I mean, the problem is that when these companies are shareholder beholden, they're driven by venture capitalist goals, you know, or shareholder goals, and they're not able.
This is the point that Orel Balcom was making on Twitter, and which he makes all the time, that when you've got companies who have shareholders, then they're always looking for an exit. The reason that they're investing in a company is to make money when you sell it or flip it or make a profit or whatever. So they're not really interested in particularly the users and that experience, etc., only in the sense that it's going to increase their particular revenues, which is why I'm so interested in co-ops and that kind of model. In terms of, I think there's a nice link here between this article and what you've been doing this week. So let me just read this from Kate Russell's answer to the question. She says, quote, "The positive is that for young people who are interested in technology, this is a really big opportunity. You'll get snapped up out of university, and when you're at the top of your field in cybersecurity, you can command a six-figure salary. And it's something you can do from a computer at home, so it's brilliant for women who would otherwise have a career break to start a family." End of quote. So there's something about preparing young people for not just going into an office and, you know, working right alongside, physically alongside other people, but working wherever you happen to choose to live. And that's what you've been kind of doing, I guess, this week.
Yeah, so I was forced into not being able to be in my lessons because of BT engineer problems. And I've had three visits so far, none of which have been fruitful. So so I taught my sixth form lessons using Slack. So I've set up a Slack channel. We went to do a local hack day. So I set up a Slack channel last year for that. And the current upper six were in that. So I did a lesson with them first. So I've written a blog post about what I did with it and about three lessons that I've taught with it, one to my upper six class and two to my lower six class. And I read Kate's article on Saturday morning and then used, so the most interesting of these three lessons is the third one, because the tools that I used in it and sort of thing, I tried some things that I've never tried before that I didn't know existed. And Amy Burville told me about TriCider. Have you ever come across TriCider before?
No, I read it in your blog post, but I haven't tried it yet.
Well, so it's, you basically pitch a question, and then that question is shareable, and you can invite it to other people. And and whatever, and then people have to put ideas down as the answers to the question, and then people can judge positives and negatives on the question and vote for that, and vote for that idea as well. So I had this really sort of, it was a really sort of interesting tool. It didn't work very well sort of in real time. So it didn't, you had to refresh the page manually rather than for it update automatically. But it's really, really interesting tool. And if you go to my blog post, you can go and click on the tri-sider that we did and see for yourself what it does.
No, I'm looking now. So you asked the question, what will be the biggest technological change over the next 10 years?
Exactly the same time as this article, yes.
And different people have put things like increase in focus on cybersecurity, 3D transistors, cyber warfare. And you can see who proposed it, and then people have added their arguments.
Yeah, they just sort of said reasons why they'd agree and why they don't agree, if they thought it was a good idea, a good response sort of thing, which was, it's a really powerful way to ask a question. And if you pick your questions carefully, back to an old teaching trick of questioning well, then people can put in different answers and what they feel about it, and also kind of push back. And you can do it anonymously, or you can register to do it.
So it's called Tri-Sider because it's divided into three. You've got ideas, pros and cons, and then votes. And presumably you can only vote on one of the ideas after it's been debated.
No, you can vote on as many as you like, but you wouldn't necessarily do that. Right. So if you click through to the actual...
You voted on several, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So I just voted on things that I thought were a good response.
You know how people do this with post-it notes after you've brainstormed ideas? You get like three little stickies that you can put on the best ideas. You could potentially, given that it shows who voted on what, you could potentially give people three votes or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, and so there's lots of really good things about it. But working remotely was really interesting. So what I wanted to achieve with these pupils, they're all computer scientists, they're all exceptional technologists, and will all go on to have they will all apply, I believe, certainly the current upper six are all applying to university to do computer science. It's a fantastic, I mean, there's only half a dozen in the class, but it's still a fantastic turnover for us. So I wanted to sort of introduce them to the idea. So with all the pupils that I teach, as they go up through the years, I try and get them introduced to the idea of working in different ways. And I get quite a lot of pushback from them on it. They don't see why they should put their work online. They don't see why they should publish things. If they do, they would rather do it on something that I provide rather than something that is in their name, as it were, a part of their identity, which is sort of quite interesting in the world of portfolios, and quite a challenge in the world of portfolios. But I want to introduce them to the ways that they're going to work beyond the classroom, that they will do more at university, that they're doing quite a lot of in-house, I'd imagine now. It's like working in WhatsApp groups and Facebook groups and on whatever to communicate and share prep and talk about prep, but they just don't really know that they're doing it, which is...
What I liked was that you shared this on Twitter, and then two of your students replied to you on Twitter saying that, awesome article, I found the remote working really good, better in fact than normal lessons because you could scroll back. And then another guy's put, I can confirm remote lessons were pretty good.
Yeah, they seem to enjoy it, I think, and not just because they do enjoy it because they get to stay, they don't have to come into the classroom, and the way the lessons worked, because we were in a boarding school, they can go home really easily back to their boarding houses, or indeed the ones that are in the day school can get home quite quickly. That's just a coincidence. Others wouldn't be able to if they go to the classroom or whatever, or they can go to anywhere and do it if they want. If they've got the computer, they can go anywhere with a bit of Wi-Fi, But they like the idea of being able to work in a different way. I think it was exciting because of that. They get that sense of accountability, I think. And this is me putting words into their mouth. So I just put things that, like, that they're not sure. When I ask a question online, they can't see who's taking the burden of the answer. So they can't see who's put hands up or who's speaking or whatever, unless someone's typing. So they all feel a greater sense of burden to answer the question because everyone has a little bit of thinking time, and then the answers start coming in, if you see what I mean.
I guess on Slack you get several people are typing.
Yes, exactly. So you get that, and so it was quite interesting. And there was also, so in the third lesson, I used 5 tools, I think, in total. So we did a little hangout at the end, just to sort of summarize what we'd done and have a little a laugh and a chat about what we'd done and talk about the prep and what homework they were going to do. And jumping to that, to the tricider, one of them we used a hack pad, but the hack pad became useless pretty quickly because we made this table of input and output devices.
Can I just ask, you know, in Slack, for example, do you feel... So Slack doesn't have threaded comments, does it? So
no.
Do you feel that that would have made it better, worse, or just different?
So the idea of being able to pursue a conversation by hashtagging it or whatever, or replying to that conversation, that particular point. I think that would have possibly made it easier for me. You can do that with emoticons, interestingly, in Slack. You can kind of give indications of what you think about something using the emoticons and reacting to something that someone said, even if it's passed by the conversation at the immediate point. But it is difficult because you're always having to at people and do that. And then and then when you're working fast, anyone who's ever worked in a sort of chat app and it's going fast, it's actually quite hard to keep following it. And I've done loads of Twitter chat things, so I'm quite sort of used to it. And you just back, like the guy said, you know, you scroll back up through the thing and you can trace the thread of the conversation and pick up the key elements to what you wish to respond to. But then you have to respond at a timely moment and to be included in the conversation as well. And the conversation.
I guess if you've got enough other channels, then people can take it to other channels. But again, going back to the power dynamic, they potentially haven't got the ability to make those channels. Also, the thing which I really appreciated was I've never found a really good use of the pinning functionality within Slack. And you said that, what did you say? You said that they pinned things to come back.
Yeah, I'm aware of pinning, so I've used it before in the Slack channels that we in for the Tide Slack channel, for example, and for We Are Open Co-op as well. And but I didn't think about it, but then one of the pupils found it. Oh, you can pin stuff. We'll just pin the articles that we find that are good that we discuss and we decide yes, that's a good source and whatever. We'll just pin that and then we can come back to it later. It'll be really easy. And that was absolutely.
You can ask it to remind you about something at a particular time as well.
You can do that. They didn't get that. But it was really a really fascinating thing to do. I really enjoyed it, and I think that I would do it more as like a standard routine thing when it lends itself to a piece of work or indeed I would if the children are not able to be in class for a particular reason or you know a couple of them are absent and but they are sitting at home and able to participate. They
could someone came along and said, "This isn't real teaching," what would you say?
I'd say rubbish. it was hard work. I had to think through everything very carefully because I actually wasn't in the room with them. I wasn't able to wing it as much in a certain way. I mean, I've been teaching a long time and certain lessons I will just walk in and teach a lesson that I've taught before or no key content that I'm going to use in that lesson and just, you know, not really plan it out. I had to be more careful in what I did with these and think about how I was going to manage things. I was really pleased with the input-output lesson I did.
So it all went pretty well. You put that one pupil disappeared?
One pupil disappeared, yeah. He just seemed to sort of say, "I'm going to do some other work while you're doing this." And there was not a lot I could do about it because we're not in the same physical space. So I did ping him and whatever, but then I just kind of thought, you know, let it go, deal with it later. Kind of stick to your guns sort of thing. But then the prep that we agreed to do at the other side at the end of the session, obviously it was recorded in the Slack channel. And I know that this particular individual is familiar with Slack because he contacts me on it all the time during the holidays, etc. I was his tutor last year, his pastoral tutor. So he went back, he found out what the prep was and he did it. And he did it to a very high standard as well. So maybe he just found it a little bit. I don't know. I haven't talked to him about why he didn't participate. He just handed the work to me and said, "Oh, I've done all the work, sir. Thank you very much."
And he's actually a bit savvy, saying, "You can do all the work. I'll sit back, get all the links, and then do the work while I've just been playing games for less."
The nature of the work was not that. It was not rigorous.
I'm being facetious, but it's interesting because I mean, what you're doing is you're blazing a trail and experimenting on other people's behalf for people who might not have the balls to do this.
Well, I wouldn't. That's a nice way of putting it. Possibly, I'm
no,
doing.
It's true
it.
Though, because I think people think, "Oh my goodness, what could possibly happen here? Oh, but maybe the kids would just go off and not do anything, and how would I control them, and oh my goodness, and I'm not going to do this.
I do stipulate that in the post, actually, is that all 12 of the pupils involved in this are fantastic. They're great academically. They're great people. We have relationships that have been forged in lessons over the last couple of years. And so
and post compulsory education, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. So what we've been talking about there is kind of digital awareness. We've talked about privacy in society, privacy in schools, tracking, crypto, digital literacy is having a civic element. You're like preparing students for not just working together and being physically co-located, but elsewhere too. Is there anything else we need to mention that before we plow on to the miscellaneous?
No, I don't think so. I think that's it's quite interesting how privacy, how all these things segue together. The idea of privacy, the idea of monitoring, the idea of pupils using digital tools in different ways and being quite agile with them.
Last thing I would say is the performativity element here. What I mean by that is the way that we act in certain situations. So, for example, when I'm working from home, you can't... I will always... This sounds terrible. I'm trying to think of a positive way of saying this. I will always use apps where you can't really definitely tell where I am and what I'm doing.
That maintain some level of privacy.
Yeah, which is why, you know, we've talked about the double tick, for example, on Telegram. I had it was a discussion with my wife the other day about the fact that she said, well, you saw that message because I saw the double tick. And I was like, well, I didn't see the message, and what are you going to trust? A messaging app, or are you going to trust me? And having that kind of discussion, if you know what I mean. And so I don't like apps that try and do social things, if you see what I mean. Like, I would say that that's a dangerous precedent to set. Like, you've seen that message, I know you have, because my messaging app told me you have, whereas actually I didn't see that thing, for whatever reason. And the same in terms of, where is Doug right now? There's no need for someone to know where I am right now, because even if I was working in an office, they wouldn't necessarily know that I was exactly in my desk. I could be somewhere else. I could be on a break. I might be on holiday. So there's something about maintaining that level of, obfuscating to some extent what you're doing, to prevent people having the level of granularity that potentially they want and potentially schools crave, and what they're doing with the tracking of kids, which when you become an adult, you try and reject to some extent to give yourself space to breathe, if that makes any sense at all.
I think that's right. So it's a bit like these wristbands that we talked about that Bill Gates is making. If you imagine these wristbands have some kind of GPS locator on them, and that you know where every pupil is in the school at all times, that becomes very big brothery and very oppressive. And I think that's kind of what you're referring to. It's like people don't get to know that I'm sitting on the loo right now, kind of thing, or whatever. It's up to you to disclose your location and what it is that you're doing.
What type of act is it? It's pushing back, isn't it? So at a time where we can be always on across time zones and whatever, like, we need that breathing room because we're expected to be always, we're expected to be like on a lot more. And so we have to control the times in which we're not on, even if it means we need to look like we are, I think you saw an element of that in your remote lessons, especially with the one who's actually like, you know, I'm not going to do this right now, I'm going to catch up with it later. They had to be very upfront with you about that, but there might be a way in which other ones might have managed their participation in a different way and done the performative element. Anyway, just, I don't want to labour the point.
It's quite possible. So in the river that's flowing by of the work that's going, I'm trying to make sure that everyone's participating and contributing. And it's quite possible that, you know, that's only as good as I am, basically. Hmm. Which is why it makes it hard work.
And it's no different, really, from sitting, looking, daydreaming out the window in class. Like, there should never be a time when we're inside people's heads. Anyway, we're going too far down that thing, you know what I mean. So, in the miscellaneous thing, a couple of things I put in here because I thought they were really interesting. So, we're all aware of the Adobe app program Photoshop, which has now become a verb to Photoshop something. And Adobe have created something called Voco, which is basically Photoshop for voice. Did you see this?
I did see this. This is great because it raises really interesting questions. But so essentially what it allows you to do is if after 20 minutes of learning my voice, someone could type some text in and it would be able to say that text in my voice and we could splice that into a sentence and it would seem like I had said it.
Yeah. Now, I can remember, I think it's Diamonds for, it's James Bond film, Diamonds Are Forever. The evil villain, whoever it is in that particular one, basically splices together lots of different bits of audio that he's got of James Bond, and lo and behold, he gets James Bond to say that, you know, I don't know, he hates Western democracy and MI5 are a bunch of bastards. I can't remember. But basically gets him to say something quite compromising. So this isn't a new idea, really. I guess it's just that we've potentially got smooth tech for anybody to be able to do it.
Yes, so it brings it to the mass market, effectively. So the fear about this is that's sort of quite interesting, is that it's going to undermine the use of audio speech recognition as a means of forensic evidence in a case of law, because you can fake it, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the concern. And the really interesting thing about this article that I liked is, can I find a bit... is that basically people are saying that this is what's already happened to images.
Yeah.
As in the same way, I quote, in the same way that Adobe's Photoshop has faced legal backlash after the continued misuse of the application by advertisers, Voco, if released commercially, will follow its predecessor with similar consequences, end quote.
I tell you what was fascinating last night. So we, have you seen the new BBC Planet Earth 2 documentary series?
I have seen the first half of the first episode, which was...
So you've seen how even more amazing than the first one it is, and how high definition it is, and how the creatures that they're showing on that program are, like, they seem almost out of this world and crazy. Like, I haven't seen those creatures before. So my five-year-old daughter is sitting there, and I've forgotten the exact question and the way that she phrased it, but her meaning was... how on earth did they computer generate such amazingly lifelike creatures, Daddy?
Digitally aware, you see? That's what we want. That is the way everything's becoming, is that you assume something is digitally manufactured unless you know it's not.
Yeah. Do you prove that? I mean, in this article, they talk about, it says... one cybersecurity researcher said the companies involved had long anticipated something like Adobe's invention. The technology is new, but the underlying principles have been understood for some time, said Dr. Stephen Murdoch from University College London. Biometric companies say their products would not be tricked by this, because the things they are looking for are not the same things that humans look for when identifying people. But the only way to find out is to test them, and it'll be some time before we know the answer. End of quote. So it's basically, even biometrics isn't enough to be able to necessarily tell what's going on here.
Well, I think the point is that so all physical things become digitized, and when a physical thing becomes digitized, it's broken down into a series of ones and zeros, and this can be faked, and no one can tell the difference because it's just a resemblance of ones and zeros. So what will happen, you'd have thought, is that there's going to be some way of I don't know. I mean, this is where blockchain would really have.
Well, this is the thing, right? So Vinay Gupta did a talk which was widely tweeted on Twitter. And the point he's making, I might be misrepresenting him here through some people, the things that people have been tweeting, is that we need blockchain to be able to preserve what really happened. Now, as a historian, I know that there is never one version of truth and what really happened, and what gets written down and recorded in the annals of history is what the winner, what the victor decided happened. So in battles, you had the Normans writing the Norman, what happened in the Norman conquest, etc., etc. And I feel like blockchain will be touted as an answer to this, like an untamperable way of saying what happened. But of course, it's garbage in, garbage out. If you write garbage into the blockchain, you get garbage out of it. And also, who gets write access really matters in this regard too. So if it's Donald Trump, then it makes no difference.
Well, it is quite interesting though, because as we touched on post-truth politics last week, and how you can prove that things are real effectively doesn't matter anyway, because it just, as long as people think that things aren't real, then they're going to not believe anything. And that's kind of the situation that we're at with politics, is that no one really trusts a manifesto that a party's elected on. Nobody really trusts a politician when things come out of their mouths. And all you end up doing is going with a kind of a feeling of trust of an individual. So, for example, from my position, Barack Obama seems a very trustworthy man of integrity. But I consider it really part of my job as an adult citizen to not believe him, not believe that that's true.
Right. There was an interesting blog post today by Scott Adams, who's the creator of Dilbert. Now, unfortunately, Scott Adams, the creator of Dilbert, who not only do I like his cartoons, but having listened to his story about how he lost his voice and managed to regain it and all this kind of stuff, it turns out he is pretty right-wing and actually a supporter of Trump, which disappointed me greatly. But hey, in this particular blog post, though, what he's saying seems pretty reasonable. This is his last blog post before people go to the polls. And what he's saying is that if you look at a video of Hillary Clinton coming off a plane a few weeks, months ago and getting into a car, and you're a Trump supporter, she looks drunk because someone said, hey, look at this drunken Hillary Clinton. Whereas if you're a Clinton supporter, she might look tired or there's nothing wrong. He says that basically the confirmation bias is kicking in here. And I feel like that's going to be true of voice and of text and of everything, really. If something seems truthy to you, then you're more likely to believe it based on your existing web of beliefs.
Yes, exactly. So you just, as you say, it's confirmation bias. You believe something because it fits with your particular belief system or whatever.
And W.V., I think I've mentioned this before, W.V. Quine, philosopher, had to study when I was doing philosophy at university. He talked about this web of beliefs and certain beliefs being more or less core to who you are and your identity, and how it's easy to give up beliefs which are not held very closely. So if I have a belief about, something I saw for the first time on Planet Earth 2 last night, and it turns out not to be true, then I can let go of that pretty easily. But if it's something like central to my being, then it's going to take a lot more to let go of that. So if you're feeding people stuff which chimes with their deeply held beliefs, they're much more likely to accept those kinds of things. Anyway, the last thing, which kind of links to this machine learning kind of vibe, is something which I thought was quite funny. There's this guy, I think it was linked to on Hacker News, and someone noticed that something, he wanted to talk about deep rhyme and computer-generated gangster rap and hip-hop, which I think is hilarious. And if you look at the lyrics, they're definitely not safe for work, but like you can imagine people actually rapping this.
Yeah, no, it looks really interesting, isn't it? It's really impressive. Clearly, this is done as a work of love, you know what I mean? To do with a childhood passion, his friends, etc. But he is a white boy straight out of Cambridge, UK, and all of this. And he puts some pretty nasty gangster rappy kind of lyrics in or whatever. And is the rap at the end that's the one that he's actually written by the computer?
All of them are, I think. The one at the end is, many thanks to my hip-hop head brother Niall for his enthusiasm as the model progressed, for some suggestions and jokes on this blog post, and for generally being a straight-up G. Play us out, D.
So I'm going to wrap this. I've actually composed it and put it to some music, and I'm about to live rap this song. Are you ready? One. No, no.
I thought you were totally going to go for it there.
But it's really cool. It's like, it's really interesting. But what's really interesting about it, so if we think about the ability of artificial intelligence, machine learning, to reproduce writing. So the way we look at this in education is always to think about how can it assess writing? Can a computer assess writing accurately as a means of assessment? Like Turnitin assesses it for plagiarism, but that's obviously clear, clean algorithms we can understand by checking copied text. This is quite interesting because it's the first sort of writing that I've seen. And there are other ones like poetry bots, aren't there, on Twitter and things like that, where they make haikus out of your tweets and that sort of thing, and trying to position the things that you talk about.
Follow Pentametron, where it takes two tweets of accounts it's following and find ones which have a rhyming end and put them to, and they have to be iambic pentameters as well, and put them together, and some of the stuff you get is just pointless, but sometimes, and because it's retweeting them within microseconds of each other, they show up next to each other on your feed. Some of it is feels like proper poetry anyway. So when I look at this kind of thing, and you have to train a neural network on a particular like canon of text, what you're doing is you're effectively replicating the status quo. You're saying, here's some stuff to train on, now do it in that kind of style, which is great and fine. But the thing which I find interesting is innovation and what comes next. Now, I don't know if you saw, and I can't actually remember if we talked about this last week, but Google have managed to train a neural network to, they basically created different personas, and you know the classic thing of Alice and Bob who want to communicate with each other cryptographically. There's Alice, Bob and Eve, and they set this neural network away to find a way to get these personas to communicate with each other in the most encrypted, privacy respect, security respecting way they possibly could. And that's what happened. And actually, no human being knows how the crypto works that the neural network created.
Yes, this is the thing. So this is machines creating cryptography, and therefore people cannot decrypt them.
Which feels a bit like Skynet, and hence the Terminator 2 image at the top of the blog post.
Yes, exactly. This rap's great. I grabbed the mic and a pocket full of beats. Now let me show you how to make ends meet, because I know that you was down with me today, but now it's time to come and get it, okay? Don't want no money. I got to make a mill. Every time you see me in the back of my grill, I'm just trying to take a look at this hoe. But then I hit the flow. We make it glow. Yo, I remember when we used to do shows, being around the world, and that's just how it goes.
So it's got internal rhyming as well as like A-B stuff as well.
Yeah, so he's done it. So yeah, exactly. He's done 10 words per line, so it's not quite accurate. And he hasn't
done.
Have you
seen that Eminem video where there's a guy who shows how clever Eminem's verse structure is?
Oh no, I haven't. I'd love to see that.
I showed my son. It's quite. Yeah, here it is. It was uploaded in 2013. It's had like 2 million views. It's like, why Eminem is one of the most impressive lyricists ever. I highly recommend you look at it. It's really good. There's also one called The History of Hip Hop, which does similar kind of things in terms of here's how hip hop has evolved over time, and here's how why we should consider our current hip hop rap artists as being up with the greatest poets.
Oh, okay. Interesting. I had a bit of I used to love Eminem back in a while, years ago.
Good to run to.
Yeah. Cool. Okay, brilliant. Well done. We're done.
We are done. Yes, so what are you up to this week?
This week, a digital learning party. So Google Plus community has now got 20 members in it. So I'm just doing some things with them. I'm going to do first teacher tech time on Friday, which I have to send the email out for all staff. I'm feeling a little bit nervous about that for some reason, because it's 5 o'clock on a Friday and I have to commit my time at that crazy time.
Promise alcohol.
Sorry?
You should promise alcohol if it's 5 o'clock on a Friday.
Well, I don't promise it, but I do give them free alcohol if they bring. But I don't want to give like people turning up and saying, "I can't work out why my spell checker's not picking this word up." you know, I want people to bring legit cases, so I'm not going to advertise the alcohol, but maybe I'll have to get people to come. The idea behind it is just that. So I think quite often people don't get their tech stuff sorted out. So I just want to give people a bit of encouragement, and you know, they can come and do it, and while they chill.
Yeah, but you know, I think it's a bit like a doctor where. Especially, you know, the stereotype of a man, like, oh, yeah, I've got this thing wrong with me, but they're actually going for something else. So, oh, yeah, my spell check is not working. And once they realise that the atmosphere is all right to kind of reveal their deepest, darkest technological worries, then they can unburden themselves.
Well, yeah, I kind of hope it's a safe place and then people can come and just, like, not feel whatever and just with it. Anyway, we'll see how that works. Okay. Yep. What about you?
So, Tuesday night, tonight, I'm flying to Jersey tomorrow. So, it's obviously, the summer timetable is finished now in terms of flights. It's now the winter timetable, so I can't fly direct from Newcastle to Jersey. So, I'm flying via Southampton, which means that those two flights are going to take out half my day. So, along the way, I'm going to do some writing for Newco Shift and other people. Then, Thursday, Friday, I will be in Jersey helping them with their digital strategy. And then, next week, before we record, if I can herd all of the cats of the two co-ops, We Are Open Co-op and Educators Co-op, who we met at MozFest and who are in California, we want to do some work together, and the lowest bar thing we can do is a webinar, and we're planning, hopefully, to do that 4 p.m. on Tuesday the 15th of November, and I think at the moment the plan is to do it around badges and that kind of thing, like a question and answer kind of session, but we'll see how that goes and how it develops.
That'd be interesting. I was contacted today actually by a parent of one of our pupils who wants to test this app he's made. It's all in the down low at the moment, so he's going to bring it in a week on Wednesday, so maybe I'll talk a little bit more about that next week. That should be fun. And the other thing to mention is when people are listening to this, it's quite possible we have a Trump or a Clinton as president of America. I wonder what that will be. So I'm just going to say good luck, Mrs. Clinton.
Indeed, absolutely. I'll tell you what, I don't know if you saw anything about the Libertarian candidate, the not very frequently mentioned Libertarian candidate who is still in the running and on the ballot paper. But there's a great clip, I think it was on Have I Got News For You. He said, so what is your, I can't remember his name, what is your response to accusations that such and such? He went, well, that is absolutely horse shit.
Well, you know, that's it. I really don't like all the Trump bashing posts that get out there, because I think that the bashing just makes people who are likely potentially going to vote for Trump vote for him more.
Yeah, it just polarizes people, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And but I did watch a clip of Susan Sarandon on NBC News, I think it was, and she was saying, it was on Newsnight, I think, and it was Evan Davis talking to her. He said, well, aren't you going to vote for Clinton because it's like a move forward for women in America? And she said, I do not vote with my vagina.
Fair enough.
But I think I think it's quite interesting. Anyway, I don't want Trump to get elected, so vote someone else in, please.
No, indeed. Right, have a good week, and thank you for listening, everybody. As usual, you can tweet us your responses to this, and also join our Slack channel, and the details of that are at tidepodcast.org. Thanks for listening.
Have a good week, everyone. Just gonna sit at the dock of a bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, sitting on the dock of a bay.